today, Tick Tock, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 14th of March 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In this week's update, we look at some of the issues in play, but given that we've been releasing daily updates in these uncertain times, we're going to try to paint the bigger picture. As the fears of a global recession triggered by the virus and oil are playing havoc with markets, social cohesion, human behaviour and finances. And central bankers are throwing liquidity at the markets, trying to support the financial system, even as those in government are trying to manage the outbreak. And as I've said before, the virus may be a catalyst for the financial mayhem we're seeing, but the seeds of destruction were laid a long time before. And as normal, we'll start with the international scene, but if you want to jump directly to the Australian segment, the time is shown below. And you can also see our post on the Australian market that we posted yesterday, including stock-specific data. See the Property Imperative Daily for the 13th of March 2020. And an important plea, YouTube has started to demonetize posts which are discussing the current financial crisis. So please support our efforts via Patreon or PayPal and send this post on as widely as possible so this gets as wide an audience as possible at this critical time. People who are not aware of what's happening may lose their shirt. Wall Street ended the week substantially down, despite a huge rally in the close on Friday, after President Donald Trump declared a national emergency, a move that gives him authority to use federal funds to combat the virus outbreak. Trump said the move would open access to up to $50 billion in funds for states and municipalities to tackle the pandemic. Trump's declaration of a national emergency, a seldom used presidential power, enables the Federal Emergency Management Agency to assist state and local governments and coordinate the US response to the crisis. The virus has killed 41 people in the United States. And later, Speaker Nancy Pelosi and President Donald Trump struck a deal on a multi-billion dollar stimulus package aimed at assisting millions of Americans directly hurt by the virus outbreak. The package aims to ease some of the economic stress by providing financial assistance to those most directly affected by the crisis, including unemployment and paid leave benefits. Combined, the aim is to calm some of the public trepidation and market turmoil of recent weeks by demonstrating that Washington policymakers can put aside partisan differences and unite quickly behind an emergency response befitting, at least in rhetoric, the severity of the crisis. The rebound in the broader market followed its worst one-day rout since 1987 and was driven mostly by financials, mostly banks, underpinned by a rise in Treasury yields. As a result, the Dow Jones Industrial Average surged 9.4% to 23,173. The S&P 500 soared 9.6% to 2,711. And by the way, it was up just 4.1% before the speech. And the Nasdaq Composite gained 9.3% to 7,874. The S&P and Dow ended the week down 9 and 10% respectively. The volatility index was down 23.37% to 5783, but remains firmly in the fear zone. The S&P Financials Index was down 20.4% across the week to 422.74, while Goldman Sachs was up 17.58% on the day, yet still down 8.13% over the week. Other banks followed suit, including JP Morgan and Bank of America, as they'll benefit from the boost in net interest income from higher interest. The strong end of the day on Wall Street comes during a week in which the Dow plunged to its biggest one-day percentage slump since 1987 on Thursday, despite the Federal Reserve pumping more than $1.5 billion of liquidity into the market. The Fed said that it would conduct three $500 billion tranches of term repos, 2 or 3 months, and one for 1 month, to support financial market functioning. The central bank has railed against suggestions that its monthly 60 billion T-bill purchases initiated in October last year to avert a repeat of a spike in overnight lending rates seen last September was a new form of quantitative easing because it's limited to short-term securities, but of course it is quantitative easing. And earlier this week, the Fed extended these purchases across a range of maturities to include bills, notes, treasury inflation-protected securities, as well as other instruments. They are effectively following the Japanese model. Still, despite the monetary and fiscal stimulus measures seen this week, the future of the global economy remains bleak. As one JP Morgan analyst put it, the virus is expected to roll through the global economy over February, March, and April, generating GDP contractions in most countries for at least one of the two quarters it straddles. If our current forecast is realized, it seems appropriate to characterize it as a novel global recession. Oil, of course, is the other story, the twist that sent markets already stressed by the virus outbreak into a tailspin was a plunge in the already weak oil price that followed Saudi Arabia's move to launch a price war with Russia last weekend. WTI ended at $32.97, up 4.67% on the week, but down 46% over the year to date. This will put pressure on many US shale oil producers, and many of whom are in deep debt. Gold futures for April delivery was down 3.85% to $1,529, and silver was down 8.2% to $1,469. These movements have confounded metals bugs, but many traders are having to make margin calls and are unwinding positions to meet them. I continue to remind our viewers that these remain risky. Their safe haven status is overblown, but nothing compares to the Bitcoin, which was 45% lower over the past month, though up 16% on Friday to $5,555. The downward move in gold was accompanied by selling in government bonds too, despite signs that the Federal Reserve is preparing to reactivate its quantitative easing program. The benchmark 10-year Treasury yield rose 3% to 0.98%, while the 30-year rose 3 points to 1.59%. Shorter maturity yields inched lower over the week, anchored by expectations of another big rate cut from the Fed next week. The three-month was at 0.276%. And Trump tweeted that the Federal Reserve must finally lower the Fed rate to something comparable to their competitor central banks. Jay Powell and group are putting us at a decided economic and psychological disadvantage. Should never have been this way. Also, stimulate. The Federal Reserve gave the market specifics on Friday about the quantitative easing program it's ramping up, declaring purchases of Treasury securities. The New York Fed's open market trading desk will buy Treasuries out to 30-year bonds to, quote, address temporary disruptions in the market. The Fed will look to buy around $37 billion in five maturity sections, with $17 billion in purchases of maturities of 7 years or more. These purchases are part of the $80 billion of planned monthly purchases, including both $60 billion of reserve management purchases and $20 billion of reinvestments of principal payments received from the Federal Reserve's holding of agency debt and agency mortgage-backed securities, the Fed said. So they are trying to influence the yield curve right out to 30 years. The euro-US dollar was down 0.69% to 1.1106, while the US dollar index futures was up 1.08% to 98.51. The US dollar remains in haven territory for now. The Bank of Canada cut the cash rate by 50 basis points to 0.75%. And in China, which bore the brunt of the economic fallout from the virus in the first few months of 2020, authorities late on Friday cut banks' reserve requirements for the second time this year. The Shanghai Composite was down 1.23% to 2,887. The US dollar yuan was down 0.28% to 7.0086. The Bank of Japan and the Reserve Bank of Australia injected liquidity into the market. The Bank of Japan offered a 500 billion yen repo, but there were only 500 million in bids. It later bought 5 and 10 year bonds outright in an unscheduled purchase to inject around 20 billion yen into the banking system, and said it would also inject an additional 1.5 trillion yen in two-week loans. The Nikkei 225 was down 6.02% to 17,442. And the Bank of Korea indicated that it was considering an emergency board meeting which would ostensibly cut rates and or provide liquidity. And the European Union said that it would establish a 37 billion euro investment initiative as part of a package of measures to cushion the bloc's economies from the impact of the coronavirus. The ECB boosted this year's asset purchases, lightened capital requirement rules, liberalised collateral requirements, suspended the annual stress tests and provided for long-term loans at a rate as much as 25 basis points below the negative 50 basis point rate. The market was frankly nonplussed. All of this was not sufficient to hold back equity losses in most large Asia-Pacific markets, including Japan, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and South Korea. However, Australian and Indian markets rose over 4%, and European markets led by utilities and materials were 3 to 4% higher. The FTSE was up 2.46% to 5,366 on Friday, and the pound US dollar was down 2.33% to 1.2277. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so, to the local markets, where bond yields have jumped 17 to 19 basis points in Australia and New Zealand, compared with 7 to 15 basis points in Europe. On Friday, the RBA added 8.8 billion Aussie dollars via a repo operation. And by the way, I've had a number of people ask about what is the repo market? It's a great question. And to get the answer to that, you should watch the show that I produced a little while ago entitled The US Repo Hiccup Was Structural and Risk Remains. And there we discuss what repos are, how they work, and what the Fed in particular is doing with them. So that's a really good source if you want to get to grips with what repos actually are. To which Chris Joy wrote, on March the 7th, I wrote to the RBA and the government again, with central banks failing to provide any liquidity as opposed to interest rate support to markets that were demonstrably starting to fail over a week ago, we are seeing, as I warned, the clear emergence of a very serious liquidity crisis, which will rapidly transform into a sovereign banking and corporate credit crisis worse than the GFC unless policymakers take rapid mitigating actions. Whilst most central banks are running out of traditional monetary policy ammo, they have an almost unlimited ability to provide massive liquidity support, which will be immensely impactful in unlocking the paralysis in global markets. This cannot just be government bond QE. It needs to be full spectrum, unrestricted QE across all sectors, including governments, banks, and corporates on a temporary basis until the virus-induced air pocket in liquidity has passed. This is precisely why we have established central banks in the first place, to serve as lenders of last resort to critical funding markets when they face crises precipitated by external liquidity as opposed to solvency shocks. Now, my problem is this. There are a number of investors who have taken positions on the assumption that the RBA would broaden its asset purchase programs to corporate bonds and mortgage-backed securities, etc., as their QE program kicks in. And encouraging the RBA to follow the Fed, the ECB, and Japan down the rabbit hole may make some investors very rich, but it becomes an ever more risky scenario as the Aussie dollar is rubbished. If the RBA does stand behind the Aussie bonds, then hedge funds might go and sell something else, but that is a really big call. And you can see my discussion with John Adams on the dilemma we now face. Economic Armageddon now requires a $782 billion repo bailout. The Australian dollar plunged from 66.35 a week back to 61.84 late on Friday. Imports just got a lot more expensive as international investors realised the weakness of our economy is showing through. And the collapse of major and regional bank share prices in the last 3 weeks has fuelled concern that banks will be constrained in their ability to raise capital, especially given social expectations that they will suspend interest payments from troubled business borrowers for the next 6 months as the virus crunches economic activity. To illustrate this, here is Suncorp's recent announcement, which will blot up capital. Effective immediately, Suncorp Bank is offering the following relief assistance options to impacted customers and business customers. First, an opportunity to defer scheduled loan repayments, including interest only, on a case-by-case basis. Second, existing loan rearranging, for example, principal and interest to interest only, with the waiver of establishment fees. Third, waive early withdrawal fees for customers wishing to withdraw from term deposits and or farm management deposits. Fourth, working capital assistance. And fifth, no interest rate increases. As Banking Day put it, banks will be required to continue raising fresh capital to support lending growth and to fund expected blowouts for provisioning against non-performing loans. In the current market environment, banks stand little chance of executing capital raisings without offering fat discounts to their already battered share prices. If the economic dislocation wrought by the global virus sparks a profound slide in credit quality, banks may have no option but to bring forward the conversion of up to $35 billion worth of hybrid securities. Many investors in these hybrids, therefore, may be in for a very rude shock. And UBS's Jonathan Mott said, given the rapidly deteriorating environment, UBS has further reduced their economic outlook. While we had downgraded our bank's EPS forecast by 3% last week, these revisions appear to be too optimistic already. As a result, we have moved our base case to what was previously our downside scenario. In the financial year 21, UBS now expects a sector EBS of around 15% below consensus. And they've also added two more severe pandemic scenarios. The new base case scenario for the calendar year 20 is for GDP to slow to 0.8%, with a recession in the first quarter and the second quarter. The RBA will cut rates to 0.25% and initiate yield curve control, essentially creating a flat curve out to 5 years. Fiscal stimulus will be 1% of GDP, and still assuming that housing lending rises a further 10%, unemployment could reach 6 to 6.5%. And implications in the following year are that the net interest margin will be down 12 basis points due to the runoff of hedges and replicating portfolios. Secondly, an additional 1% in cost efficiency. Thirdly, credit impaired charges rise by around 24 basis points. And they've downgraded the financial year 21 EPS forecast by 6% across the sector, with a return on equity of 9.2%. And they now expect dividends to be cut and CBA's buyback to be postponed. And collective provisions will be topped up as banks move to internal downside scenarios under AASB 9 credit provisioning, which is more pro-cyclical. And they now expect each of the major and regional banks to increase the weightings of their downside or stress scenarios in their collective provisions due to the rapid deterioration of the economy. And as a result, they have increased their credit impairment charges by around $500 million for each major in the upcoming first half 20 results, which of course is the second half for CBA. However, we have a low level of confidence in these numbers as it could change material as the situation unfolds. And Damian Klassen at Nucleus Wealth takes this knotty question even further by looking at what unemployment will do to the housing market. He wrote that the attitude in Australia is that the housing market is bulletproof, ScoMo has its back, and that all investors have to fear is fear itself. Banks had the debt handbrake on in 2019 as a Royal Commission demanded they lend responsibly, but in 2020, egged on by the Treasurer and APRA, the banks were falling over themselves to get back to the irresponsible lending of the 2012 to 2017 era. The boom was back, baby. But as much irresponsible lending as possible won't increase house prices when unemployment starts to rise. For example, Perth showed us that during the same 2012-17 period, unemployment was rising much more significantly in the West. And as a result, home prices have dropped considerably. So unemployment is the trend to watch. And so to the housing sector, where the CoreLogic Index, seemingly in a different world, still rose, even if more slowly. It's worth remembering that Perth, with a higher unemployment, in the same credit conditions, are still down 21% from peak. Price growth does appear to be slowing elsewhere. Now, this should be a warning, and auctions were a little lower last Saturday with a clearance of 74.8% compared with 47.8% a year ago. Sydney was the standout at 82.6%, but there, of course, were long weekends in some other states. But now we wait to see if the virus starts to impact listings and sales. As I discussed with Edwin Almeida, our property insider this week, see the property listing pandemic. And we are certainly seeing some signs of mortgage lending slowing again, despite strong figures for January, which came out this week, while overall credit growth is slowing as many households pay loans down. There was a rise in new, mainly owner-occupied borrowers. Meanwhile, in New Zealand, median home prices across New Zealand increased by 14.3% in February to a new record median price of $640,000, up from $560,000 a year back. This was the largest percentage increase in 53 months, according to the latest data from the REINZ. And the number of properties sold in February across New Zealand increased by 9.2% from the same time last year, making it the highest number of properties sold in the month of February in 4 years. For New Zealand, excluding Auckland, the number of properties decreased just a little, but in Auckland, the number of properties sold in February increased by 41.6% year on year, the highest number of residential properties sold in the month of February in 5 years. And the House Price Index for New Zealand, which measures the changing value of property markets, increased 8.7% year on year, and that's a new record high. The HPI for New Zealand, excluding Auckland, increased 10.2% from February 2019, and the Auckland Home Price Index increased by 6.9% year on year. And that's the highest increase in 35 months, and the first time the Auckland region has crossed the 3,000 mark. In February, the median number of days to sell a property decreased nationally by 12 days, from 47 to 35, when compared to February 2019. And that's the lowest days to sell for the month of February in 13 years. And the total number of properties available for sale nationally decreased by 22.3% in February to 20,875. And that's a decrease of more than 5,975 properties compared to a year ago. And that's the lowest level of inventory for the month of February ever. The question, of course, is whether the virus will kill the market ahead, which has been supported by ultra-low interest rates and with possibly another Reserve Bank New Zealand interest rate cut ahead. And we'll be discussing our updated scenarios and what households should be considering in our live show, which will be streamed at 8 p.m. Sydney time on Tuesday. The details are in the comments below. And you can send me a question in beforehand via the DFA blog or ask live via the chat on the night. Mark your diary. This could be one of the most important shows that you've ever watched. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.